Species.
Unite.
Species.
Unite.
I give a presentation to law students on animal law every now and then, and I tell them I can teach you everything you need to know about federal animal protection law in 10 seconds. And I say there isn't really much. There are very few laws, especially at the federal level, protecting farmed animals.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. This conversation is with Chris Locke. Chris is an attorney, and he's an animal welfare and humane education advocate. He works in New York City and has advocated for the carriage horses in Manhattan. The carriage horse issue has been going on for decades and decades. Horses are hit by cars. They collapse in the streets. It's a horribly abusive industry, and yet it continues. Chris also advocates for animals up to the federal level. He came on the show to talk about animals and our legal system, its many limitations, and the places where he finds hope. Chris, thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Hi. I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Your story is so cool to me because I so rarely get to talk to someone who literally is like, well, I didn't really like animals.
So I'm a lawyer by trade, and by personality, I am not an animal person. I never grew up with any animals. I had really bad allergies to dogs and cats as a kid. I still do. I grew up eating meat with every meal. I'm pretty sure there was a two-year period of my life where I only ate chicken fingers. My whole family's the same way. And, you know, because of my allergies, because I never lived with animals, I've always been a bit skittish around them. Even when your dog jumped up on me, I can feel that inner child still recoiling a bit. And, you know, I still don't really, in my heart of hearts, have that affinity that some people who grow up with animals really have, and that a lot of people in the animal advocacy community have. But you know, when I was in law school, I read, on a whim, Peter Singer's Animal Liberation. I had heard a lot of people talk about it and just seemed like an interesting piece of culture to consume. And I read through it, and I read through it real quick because it was really interesting to me. And I set the book down, and I thought for about a minute. I said, well, I guess I have to completely change how I interact with animals. And really, more or less from there, I dropped meat from my diet right away and gradually phased out other stuff. I knew even then that really the ethically coherent step to do would be to drop all animal products altogether. It was a little hard of a jump for me right then.
A lot of people like change their lives because of Peter Singer's book. For people who haven't read Peter Singer's book, will you just talk about what about it like changed you so much?
You hear people say that it's very hard to argue someone out of a position that they didn't argue themselves into. But this is really an exception because I read the book and the thing that appealed to me most was not his chapters about how horribly farmed animals are treated or animals in research. That obviously got me at an emotional level. But again, I never had that intuitive empathy that children probably have for animals. The thing that really got to me was a real basic philosophical argument he makes, and he draws on the English philosopher Jeremy Bentham for it. Really simply this: if you have a choice to eat food that doesn't cause suffering to a being that can feel suffering, or you have a choice where you can avoid that food and cause a little less suffering, which choice should you choose? And just from a real basic common sense perspective, put aside if you grew up with your pet dog, with your pet cat, a horse. If you're just an ethical person or value, you know, creatures avoiding suffering, you have to pause there and say, hold on a second. If I'm making a choice every time I sit down with a meal, I could have something that causes a lot of suffering to animals, or I could have something that doesn't. And that just really got to me at a gut level.
So it started with meat, and then you kept going food-wise.
Yeah. I mean, it's the meat, animal products distinction is, you know, I get it in practice. It's a lot easier to say you're vegetarian than vegan, or at least historically it has been. But it's a lot harder to draw an ethical distinction on why, you know, an ice cream cone is really any different from a steak.
And it's interesting, most vegetarians that I know now versus even 10 years ago, and I was a vegetarian 10 years ago, I think it was easier to be conditioned. We didn't know as much. You just didn't have the same awareness that kids grow up with now. I mean, I knew dairy was horrible as a kid, but and when I became a vegetarian, but it was an easy, it's a lot easier to kind of block out versus now the only vegetarians I meet are old, like older, or they're kids whose parents won't let them be vegan yet. Maybe it's my bubble too.
I think that's right. I think most of the people who, even people who identify as vegetarians, recognize that as well and acknowledge it more as a practical compromise than anything that's really that ethically consistent. I think the thing that really got to me then and that still sits with me now, and it's disturbing really, is that I could have lived so much of my life without even having thought about that I should care about animal suffering. And it's disturbing that I was able to live that long without even crossing my mind. But at the same time, there's something hopeful about it because, you know, I do think, and I was listening to your interview with Delcy Winders, and she said in their heart of hearts, most people really, you know, love animals and they don't want animals to be treated the way we treat them. And I do think that's true. A lot of it is just people, it's so ingrained in our culture to eat animals that we don't really even think about what we're doing.
I don't think most people think about it. I mean, I was a vegetarian for decades before I went vegan. And clearly I knew the dairy industry was a horrible place. But it's easy to block stuff out if you don't want to go there. It's good you went there. And thank you, Peter Singer, because you've done a lot for animals since. So how did it start affecting your work?
I read Animal Liberation when I was in law school. And I was lucky enough to go to a law school that had an animal law class. That's more and more popular now. It's still not in every law school. And my professor, David Wolfson, who's an amazing lawyer and an amazing animal advocate, he really was a model of how you could balance a lawyer's day-to-day job, even a corporate, you know, law firm lawyer's job, with animal advocacy. And when I got out of law school, I went to a law firm doing corporate litigation, which, you know, I enjoyed, but I was able to, both in my pro bono work at the firm and then also outside of work, become involved in animal advocacy. What really, you know, got me deep into the world of animal law and animal advocacy was joining the New York City Bar Association's Animal Law Committee. The Animal Law Committee of the New York City Bar is the first and longest running committee of lawyers who are dedicated exclusively to animal law. It's been around since around 1990. That's really where I started merging both my legal interests and my day-to-day lawyering with my interest in animal advocacy and seeing how much that, you know, a lawyer who's trained to be persuasive in writing and in oral argument can use those very same skills to help advocate for animals.
Well, talk about some of the things you were advocating for.
We've worked on bills like the New York State a few years back became the first state in the nation to ban declawing of domestic cats. Declawing is not trimming the nails of a cat. It is cutting off the top knuckle, the third phalanx on the cat's paw, which is a painful procedure and which has lasting effects on the cat's physical health and behavior. And so that was a great success. And then at the federal level, just in December, Biden signed into law the Big Cat Public Safety Act, which would ban the ownership of private ownership of big cats like lions and tigers. It's an exciting time in some ways for animal lawyers. I'm surprised at the amount of legislation there is. There are still a lot of tough spots.
A lot's happened this year. Also, the FDA Modernization Act passed and New York cosmetics ban.
Yes.
New York puppy mill ban. Like, it's an awesome time.
The amount of interest that we've had from lawyers to become members of the committee has just, you know, increased over the years.
The Animal Law Committee at New York City Bar, for years before I was even doing Species Tonight, like, I'd be talking about something and people talked about you guys because you're kind of famous in the animal world in the sense for getting things done. Let's just take a few of these successes for a minute, because I want to know, but I'm sure a lot of people want to know, like something like the Big Cat Safety Act, which passed this year, Biden signed it. It's awesome. Tiger King probably helped it a lot.
Yeah.
But it was in for like 10 years, right? It took about 10 years. Why do things like that? Like, you can't own a pet tiger. That you would think that would just be like obvious that should be the law. Why do things like that take 10 years?
It's a great question. I'm probably not alone in saying this, but it is almost impossible to know what legislation will move forward and when. The amount of reports and bills that the Animal Law Committee advocates for each year is much, much more than the bills that ever get passed, than the bills that ever really get much attention. In New York State, for instance, bills have to be introduced in both the state assembly and the state senate. There's many, many bills that don't even make it to both houses. And, you know, the legislative process can be frustratingly slow, and sometimes it takes things that are really external to any real lobbying, like, for instance, Tiger King and the attention that gets, to really get things going. Or sometimes it's a bill gets passed in another state and maybe there's a renewed focus. But it is a bit of a mystery of why certain bills move forward. Sometimes, you know, it's inspired by legislators, like our city council, you know, has had a lot of animal advocates on it. But, you know, it's the frustrating reality that there are bills that might strike you or me as obvious, as simple fixes, that go nowhere.
Yeah.
And you advocate for them. And legislation's a slow process in general. And animal protection legislation can be an especially slow and frustrating process.
Absolutely. Well, like, for instance, the horse carriages in New York.
Yeah.
That's one you would think would be a no-brainer as well. And it comes up all the time.
That is an issue that has been going on for decades and decades. I've spoken on the history of the efforts to ban carriage horses. And in the 80s, the city council had passed a number of regulations over the industry in the wake of some incidents where horses collapsed or died. And interestingly enough, even then, Mayor Koch at the time had vetoed the bill. And it was only over a supermajority where two-thirds of the city council voted to enact it despite the veto. And that was one of just a handful of vetoes during Mayor Koch's entire period.
But he was vetoing. You weren't talking about banning it.
These were city council efforts to just restrict, put time and place restrictions on the carriage horse industry. There have, though, been in the past, you know, 8 years or so, some efforts to tighten restrictions. There was a rule by the New York City Department of Transportation to move the carriage horse boarding areas from Grand Army Plaza in the southeast corner of Central Park into the park. There was a city council law that was enacted a few years ago to restrict the temperature range within which carriage horses can be operate. But I mean, look at those. Those are the two examples I'm citing. They're very incremental changes.
And were those the same thing, Koch? Like rejected.
There was
the
no 80s. Veto. There was no veto on those, but there was a lot of opposition. I represented, when I was at a law firm, pro bono, the Animal Legal Defense Fund, on a Freedom of Information Law request to try to get documents from the NYPD about carriage horse accidents. And we had to go to court to ultimately get that. There was such a pushback to producing just a few hundred documents. It was a months-long fight.
Why?
You know, I think, well, on the one hand, the NYPD does not have a great reputation with Freedom of Information Law requests. That's something that's been documented over the years, no matter who's making the request. But there is, I think throughout the city, there's just as much as there's been animal advocates' attention toward the carriage horse issue, there's a lot of intransigence and fighting against it. And that's that kind of, it permeates a number of different groups. So I'd like to think we weren't singled out for opposition, but it really was a fight. We had to do many filings. We challenged the agency actions within the agency when they still didn't produce. They told us they had no documents at all. We had to go to court. The judge eventually ordered them produce documents, and we finally got it. So it was a success there. But the amount of, we were lucky to have a law firm providing pro bono services, but to help get that result. But you have to imagine, if somebody doesn't have that connection or those resources, the amount of work you would have needed to get just
that far,
a few documents.
What was in these documents?
So they were accident reports, various types of police reports on carriage horse accidents, collisions with automobiles, some related issues, including a number of ones that never made the press, that weren't really documented. And it showed our suspicion as true, which was that there are probably a lot more accidents than ones that get the news.
And so, like, with a situation like that, with the horse carriages in New York, now, as a New Yorker, and so this is coming very much from a bubble, but I feel like everybody in New York, like everyone I know, not just animal people, it thinks the carriage horse industry is horrible. And everyone's like, well, it's tourist drives the demand. No New Yorker would ever get in one of those things. I don't know if that's true. If at least a huge part of the city is pretty disgusted and appalled by just abuse in front of your face, what are the hurdles? Why is this still coming up year after year?
I do think that the tourist piece is a big part of it. Most New Yorkers I know can't stand Times Square, but you go there on a Friday night, the place is packed and it's doing a lot of business. And anecdotally, because I haven't seen any studies of this, my sense is that a lot of the people who are taking carriage horse rides are not native New Yorkers, but are in town visiting. So I think that's a piece of it. Another piece is that, you know, and to their credit, the carriage horse drivers and owners have really been an effective advocacy group for their own interests. They've banded together. They are very organized they monitor the legislation just as well as animal advocates do. And, you know, they advocate for it. And, you know, that's part of the process too. Yeah. And they have been very effective in advocating for their interests. To me, it still doesn't overcome the fact that we have horses walking through Midtown when I'm scared to even drive through Midtown. But I do think that's a lot of what's going on too. They're a vocal and well-organized group that's opposing really any efforts to put aside banning the industry, but any efforts to even just heighten restrictions on the industry. Moving the carriage horse boarding areas, for instance, you know, a few hundred feet from Grand Army Plaza inside the park, there was a day-long public hearing before the Department of Transportation with a line outside the door of people testifying for that rule, in support of the rule, and against it. So it's really, for whatever historical reason, it's hard to imagine a bill that gets an issue in New York City that gets quite so much fighting for just even the most incremental efforts.
It feels like once it is banned, I mean, at some point it's got to be, right?
I'm hopeful it will be.
It might open doors for some other things because it's like, it's the big holdout.
I would hope so. You know, I do struggle with the issue a bit because end of day, there are a few hundred carriage horses in the city. And when you pause and think about the billions of animals, just land animals that we use in the United States every year, part of you has to say, hold on, there's a lot of attention going to these carriage horses. The way I've resolved that issue is that it's, as an animal advocate, and I think anybody who's done this will say the same thing, it can be a very frustrating, disheartening, you know, role to play. Victories are often small and separated by many, many years and a lot of hard work. And sometimes they end in compromises that you don't love, especially when you're doing legislative advocacy. And, you know, I think animal advocates need to take there's no limit on the amount of issues you can put your attention to. And sure, as a pure numbers thing, the farmed animals that we eat and that we use for food make the amount of carriage horses just seem like a tiny, tiny fraction of a fraction. But at the same time, the carriage horse issue is a local issue. It's one in front of every New Yorker's face. And it's an issue that I'm hopeful we could be successful on in the short term.
Obviously, I'm against the carriage horses, but one of my big fights, like personally, that I mean, one thing that just makes me insane is what we're doing to wolves in the West.
Yeah.
And it's like a massacre. It's a there's not that many wolves, right?
Yeah.
But I can't leave it alone. It breaks my heart. But so do pigs
Absolutely.
And cows and all the rest of it. But one thing I've realized since I've kind of been on this wolf, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, is it's something I can talk to non-animal rights
exactly.
people about and get them really angry. Right. And it's like, it's a tiny doorway, but it's getting them to care about an animal they don't know, you know, or like isn't their dog or isn't a cat. It's a wolf. It's pretty close to a dog. So I think with the horse carriages, there's similarities. It's not just animal people. It's like, it's New Yorkers.
Yeah. That's such a great observation. And that's something, especially doing legislative advocacy, that is really, you have to recognize that the audience you're speaking to for advocating for farmed animals is going to be a very different audience that you're speaking to for domestic animals, for dogs and cats, and for horses. And in some way, that can be frustrating because to you or to me, there's really not that much of a difference between a dog or a pig or a cow. But the reality is for a lot of people, there is, at least until they learn more. And that's a reality that animal advocates can use to their advantages, especially in advocating for legislation, because you can advocate for something like New York State's pet sales ban to people who might walk off and have a steak right after. And look, that bill got passed. And I think part of the reason, or a lot of the reason it got passed, was because of people's affinity toward dogs and cats. While there's something ethically inconsistent about it, you take what victories you can.
No, you have to.
Especially in this world. If I were to exclusively advocate based on numbers of animals, I'd be disheartened within a week, especially for legislative advocacy.
Well, and the laws for farmed animals are so barely there, right?
It's true.
Last week, the footage from Smithfield's pig gas chambers came out. Did you see it?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you don't think much can shock you anymore after you've seen so much bad stuff for so long. You kind of almost get a little bit numb to it. This was literally like learning about slaughterhouses and factory farms and everything else at once for the first time. It's that shocking. And it was in Wired.
Wow.
You see the pigs go into the gas chambers and you watch them die because they got hidden cameras in there.
Awful.
Because it did get mainstream media attention.
Yeah.
does that do anything? I don't know. But because like you're like, I can't believe we still have carriage horses. We are putting animals in gas chambers. And these are mass numbers of animals we're putting in gas chambers. And they are dying horrific deaths. It was shattering to watch.
It's something I've struggled with, is the sheer amount of numbers and amount of cruelties that we inflict on farmed animals. It's one of the things where you really see the limits of law. As you mentioned, there are very few laws, especially at the federal level, protecting farmed animals. I give a presentation to law students on animal law every now and then, and I tell them, I can teach you everything you need to know about federal animal protection law in 10 seconds. And I say, there isn't really much.
And that's horrible. Oh my God.
It's not entirely accurate, because there's the Animal Welfare Act. There's the Endangered Species Act. There are federal laws. But if you see the point of animal protection laws as stopping wanton cruelty against many, many billions of animals, in that sense, there really isn't any federal animal protection law. Because, you know, I think it's 9 or 10 billion land animals, put aside fish in the ocean, that get killed every year for food. That's despite having federal laws that nominally protect animals. And even at the state or local level, there really isn't anything that dramatically, you know, reduces the suffering of animals, even if you have laws like in California, cage-free laws. The reality is there's still billions of animals every year that get killed for food.
And they suffer, the cage-free birds suffer almost equally to cage birds.
Exactly. So it's something that I think probably any animal advocate struggles with, is how can you, in some sense, how can you advocate, how can you put your attention to anything but that one issue? But again, unless you want to be so disheartened and feel like things are unsolvable, if you want to do legislative advocacy, you have to also focus on smaller issues. And I think there's really something to be said about that.
And how do the students respond to you when you say that?
I think most students and most people intuitively might get that there's not much animal protection law at the federal level, simply because they've seen, especially the students I've spoken to, tend to be familiar with the state of animals in the country. But I think people are surprised, even people who are familiar with how we treat animals. I think people are surprised that there, for instance, is a federal bill called the Animal Welfare Act that in practice doesn't change at all how we treat the animals we use for food. And then when they learn that even the animal protection laws that are on the books don't really get enforced much at all.
There's not really anything there to begin with. And then a lot, it's not enforced, a lot of it.
It makes you realize the limits of law and legislative advocacy and how important it is to change people's minds. I think even the most optimistic person isn't expecting, our U.S. Senate and Assembly to pass any, you know, expansive bill to protect farmed animals. And so even in the next decade, I'm sure most people would think that's a pipe dream. And so I think, as much as I'm still very focused on advocating for animals through legislation, any realist has to understand that there's a lot of other efforts that are really important to do besides simply advocating for laws, even if it's just having conversations with people, education. And so, you know, over the years, I wouldn't say I've become cynical about the effect of laws, because I still think there's such a lot of important advocacy and laws that can be done, and efforts to increase enforcement are really important. But it's really important to also see the full picture, which is that laws very often tend to come after public opinion starts to shift. Laws typically don't become law before anyone's you know, wants them to be passed. Usually the tide of public opinion slowly turns and then the law is the last thing to flip over. And there are a number of examples of that outside of the animal advocacy realm. Gay marriage, for instance, the tide of public opinion really has shifted, you know, wonderfully over the decades. And, you know, it culminated in laws changing. It didn't really go the other way around. And so I think it's become more and more important to me to not just think about animal advocacy as something to do through a legal lens.
You're really involved now with HEART, which is, I can't remember what it stands for.
Humane Education Advocates Reaching Teachers. Yeah, one of the issues that through the City Bar's Animal Law Committee got on my radar was humane education. The goal of humane education is to teach young children empathy with animals, with the environment, and with other people. I think what appealed to me is that it's something you could do right here and now. In other words, if a teacher is teaching his or her classroom about the importance of empathy to animals, to the environment, to other people, you're doing something right then and there in a way that if you're advocating for legislation, you might not see the fruits of your advocacy for a decade. You right. might not ever see the fruits of your advocacy. So the immediacy of that really appealed to me and is why I've seen that as a complement to some of the other animal protection efforts I've been involved in.
It's hopeful.
It is hopeful. And the other thing I think that's appealed to me is that in advocating for animal protection legislation, very often that legislation, what it's doing is it's tackling the treatment of animals on the back end. It struck me as more and more important over the years that you can't just tackle things from a after the fact, let's increase penalties, let's increase the amount of laws to protect animals. You also have to tackle it from the front end, changing people's minds, changing people's way of seeing the world and interacting with the environment and animals. And so over the years, that's got me, it's really spoken to me and been a nice counterbalance to some of the more back-end legislative or legal
yeah.
actions.
I think for so many kids, for decades or centuries or forever, the story was always, kids are pretty empathic. Maybe you weren't toward animals, but most kids are.
Yeah.
Right? And that gets kind of like just stomped out of them by, I don't know, third grade, fourth grade. It's like, nope, we eat animals. This is how it is. That we do this. This is how it is. And what HEART does, one of the things HEART does and humane education does, is says, no, instead we're going to nurture that.
Yeah. I think that's a great observation. And the receptivity of kids to the lessons and to learning about empathy with animals, with people, with the environment, it really is amazing. And the other thing that really drew me to this is I had my own kids and seeing them, they don't take after their father in the sense that they really have just an intuitive love of animals. And it's amazing to see that without any legal arguments, without reading any Peter Singer, without reading animal case law, you know, they've learned lessons that it took me decades to learn. And it's very hopeful. And if you need something to counterbalance the disheartening effects you sometimes feel advocating for animals, it really is wonderful to see how children react to these issues. And what's really nice about humane education too, is that unlike advocating for laws, there is something inherently bipartisan about it. Teaching children about kindness and empathy, it's easy to get a consensus about. And so there's something nice, and again, a counterbalance to the legislative process, which tends to be adversarial, or even if it's not very adversarial, there's very often opposition.
But you're still going to fight for them, right?
Absolutely. And look, it's a skill set I have it's my job. I advocate for positions every day. And so it's the only way I really know how to firsthand advocate for animals is through that legal lens. But it's just been increasingly important for me to balance that. So there is a little bit of a balancing with approaching something that is takes me out of the lawyer mindset.
Chris, thank you for everything that you do.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you. And I love listening to your podcast and all the wonderful guests you have on it. I'm honored to be with you.
Thank you so much. To learn more about Chris, to learn more about animals and the law, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and can do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knutson, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.